Welcome to the Culture and Sports Podcast, where we have discussions about how leadership and organizational culture impact organizational success, team and athlete performance, and the short and long-term mental, physical, and emotional health of athletes. The Culture and Sports Podcast is brought to you by Culture and Sports. Culture and Sports helps sports organizations, teams, coaches, support and front office staff, and athletes understand the importance of leadership and organizational culture and its direct impact to success. Please join Lori Okamura and Dr. Jeremy Piasecki in this season of the Culture and Sports Podcast. Welcome back to the Culture and Sports Podcast. Today we introduce John Manley. John is the nation's top attorney representing victims of sexual abuse and assault. Over the past 25 years, John and his legal team have been heavily involved in the most significant sexual abuse actions litigated across this nation. He served as lead counsel for the victims of former Olympic women's gymnastics team doctor Larry Nassar, USC gynecologist George Tyndall, and many others, and they achieved the largest sexual abuse settlement in history. Additionally, Mr. Manley has required numerous institutions to make policy changes to ensure no child or athlete under their care is ever abused again. Just like you, Lori, he is a graduate of the University of Southern California, and he received his law degree from Pepperdine University. John Manley is a formidable advocate for victims' rights and against the criminals who would hurt them. Thank you so much for joining us today, John.
Thanks for having me.
Can you please share a little bit about your work and why protecting and empowering athletes is so important to you?
Sure. Well, I am a real estate lawyer by training, but in 1997, one of our real estate client's sons came to us and said he was abused by a priest. And the diocese lawyer, when we approached him on behalf of the family, because the family just wanted counseling and his meds paid for, told us to go fuck ourselves. The lawyers did. So, I don't know, it just sort of offended me. So, in any event, my former partner and I litigated the case until 2001, where they settled for $5.2 million, which at the time was the largest pretrial settlement in the history of the Catholic Church. And my phone rang off the hook, and I became a plaintiff lawyer. So, since then, I've literally done thousands of cases where I represent children or adults abused as children, including multiple athletes, child athletes, adolescents, and collegiate athletes where they've been abused. And that's our firm's sole focus. And, a lot of people know us from the Larry Nassar case, but we've been doing it long before that.
Now, obviously, these things don't happen. You know, the person's hired one moment, and then they're abusing, you know, whether it's physically, mentally, emotionally, sexually, you know, they're abusing them, and then the next day is reported. So if we could kind of go back in time, how does hiring of these coaches or perpetrators start? Is it negligent hiring that's part of the abuse cycle for athletes, or how? How, in your experience, have you seen that these coaches and just extremely toxic and abusive people end up coming into these roles?
I think one of the things you have to think about is frequently abusive coaches or abusive people don't appear to be abusive initially, right? Now, you know, if somebody has a background and you fail to look at it, no matter how nice they are, then obviously you're not doing your job, especially at a college. It's very rare that somebody at the collegiate coaching level shows up for a job and doesn't have a background in abusing kids. It just, you know, it's like if you think of Bobby Knight, who in my view was one of the most abusive coaches in history. And, you know, people from Indiana will, you know, faint, but I mean, he was a horrible human being. Who would hire him after the stunts he pulled in Indiana? Those were well publicized, but whether it's Division III, II, 1A or 1, the college coaching world for sports is a very small world, and everybody kind of knows everybody's reputation. So It frankly, I've never heard of a college hiring somebody that was an abusive coach that either physically, sexually, emotionally, or otherwise, who didn't have a history of it.
Now, how, I guess the biggest question with this is, teachers in the education world, especially primary, secondary education, there's this thing called pass the trash, where teachers will go from school to school or school district to school district or different state to different state. Those organizations will be more than happy to get rid of the person and even write them a letter of recommendation just so that teacher could be gone because of extremely toxic or abusive things that they've done. Does that happen with a lot of college athletic coaches or even just in national governing bodies? Have you seen a lot of that? Do you
Oh,
think
sure.
that contributes to this?
Yeah, sure. I mean, before Steve Penny, who was the former president of USA Gymnastics, got the USA Gymnastics, he was associated with USA Cycling when Lance Armstrong was there. The idea that, the whole pass the trash notion is very true. Sometimes it's because the institution doesn't want to. A lawsuit like the former coach at Michigan State is initiated against them, or other reasons. And it's easier just to say, oh, this guy's great, and then you dump him off, and he shows up, and you got yourself a real problem, or she shows up, and you got yourself a real problem. But frankly, the fault with that lies squarely, in my view, at the athletic director. And also the culture of the school. What's particularly distressing in these types of cases is when you have public institutions, for example, Michigan State with the Nassar case, where you have public money involved and public money paying these coaches frequently a lot of money nowadays, and they're known to be precisely the opposite of what the institution's supposed to stand for. If you look at one of the things we've done in a lot of our collegiate cases is go to the motto of the university, which invariably is, where there is truth, there is light, and it's usually in Latin. And when you compare that with their conduct, it's utter hypocrisy. This is supposed to stand for progress, for liberal education, for doing what is right. And frequently, it's doing what is right for the institution's financial well-being as they perceive it, not for the children they're supposed to educate. And when I say children, I'm not exaggerating. They're 16, 17-year-old kids, minors that go to these schools. They're 16 and 17-year-old athletes in some of these programs, and they put these people in there. And I can think of a number of examples where that person who's not fully developed, is abused by these coaches, and the results can last a lifetime. And I want to be clear what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about somebody raising their voice once or twice. I'm not talking about hey, you screwed that play up, or even necessarily using harsh language. I'm talking about real physical abuse, pushing, shoving, slapping, you fat bitch. You fucking asshole. And I've seen it. I've seen it personally at a high school level. I was actually thrown off a this is a true story. I was thrown off a high school football field when I was doing the at a football game when I was doing the sticks with another crew because the opposing team's coach grabbed his young quarterback by the neck and was screaming, "You fucking idiot! I told you not to fucking do that." And I said, "If you say one more fucking word, sir, I'm going to call Child Protective Services." And he almost punched me on the sidelines. But that's the appropriate response to people that abuse athletes, not to enable them and not to hire some corporate law firm at $1,500 an hour to do a bullshit investigation. Excuse my language.
No, you're totally fine, John. The specific case that we're looking at this season for the Culture and Sports Co podcast is University of Idaho women's volleyball team. They're an NCAA Division I program.
They've had a storied history. The last few years, their history has not been very positive. But one of the things that I asked about earlier about Pass the Trash, Lori brought up a couple episodes ago about their current coach has been in a number of programs. If you want to elaborate on this a little bit more, Lori, but he's been in a number of programs the last two decades. And it definitely seems like it might be a Pass the Trash situation.
Yeah, sure. So, John, you know, our case study that we're looking at, the coach that's at the University of Idaho, and by the way, is still the coach, even after, you know, a 10-page formal complaint, has a, you know, the entire, I think, timeline of this gentleman's, you know, arrival at Idaho was captured in a pretty detailed, I think it was almost 11,000-word article by Scott Reed at the Orange County Register, not in Idaho, right? So it took somebody from outside, you know, of the city. And Scott had a pretty interesting statistic that over approximately 21 years of this gentleman's career, he had actually been at 15 different institutions, and some of them for really only a season, not even a full year, before either being let go, terminated, fired flat out, you know. And a pattern, as you referenced, you know, earlier, a pattern began to emerge. You know, in our sport, in volleyball, I've been in volleyball my whole life. You know, we call it like the three phone call effect, right? There's not anybody that you can't make three phone calls about that you can find out, you know, some type of information, especially if you're vetting a hire or, you know, or trying to vet a position. So I guess one of the, you know, one of the things that's very interesting about this case is that pass the trash theory, you know, or actual practice of, you know, moving these people in and out. Like, it's not my problem anymore because I already terminated his contract. Well, then you move to the next school and the same thing happens. And shortly after, the women at Idaho on this current 2023 fall season team, right, certainly after they told their story and started to, you know, make their complaint, there were women coming out from, gosh, as long ago as I think there was a woman from a 2003-2004 volleyball season that recounted almost verbatim the same type of behavior, you know, that these women in 2023 were experiencing. So there's this, you know, real, like, if you could call it a research study or effect, I mean, this is a real example, right, of the negative effects. You know, one of the things I think I'd like to you know, hear more about or maybe get a little bit more context, you know, as usual, the you know, one of the first reactions, well, first there was no reaction by the university for over two seasons. And then, as reported, an independent investigation, right? It's complete horseshit, you know, independent investigation run by a law firm, you know, out of state, who one of their associates was actually, you know, the Title IX coordinator for this whole investigation on campus at Idaho. So, you know, I think from the women's perspective, and we, you know, we will this season hear from some of the women, you know, from that team, as well as others, right, who had suffered abuse at the hands of this coach. I guess, you know, the understanding of how these quote unquote independent investigations really work, right, I think is really, it's a misunderstanding. People think, oh, great, there's a law firm that's hired and, you know, they're going to get to the bottom of this and we're going to get, you know, we're going to get justice. But really the reality of the situation, I'm sure, and from your perspective and your experience over these last, you know, all these decades that you've been fighting on the right side of it, you know, what does this independent investigation really look like?
Well, I can tell you, independent investigation is about, you know, is about the most inaccurate term you could use when you talk about these situations. First of all, you know, in every case I've been involved with, from, you know, USA Gymnastics to a case I've got pending against Los Angeles County right now involving boot camp, juvenile boot camps where, you know, young women were abused in their teens. They always want to hire an independent law firm. They say independent. Well, independent sounds like, oh, you don't have a relationship with either party and you're going to go out and find the facts independently. That's not how it works. Every one of these law firms has an attorney-client relationship with the entity that hires them. So, for example, in USA Gymnastics, they hired a former Indiana prosecutor who they said was independent to interview the client. And I wrote her, and she wanted to interview, you know, some of our Olympians like, you know, Allie Raisman and others. And I wrote her a letter and said, do you have an attorney-client relationship with USA Gymnastics? She said, no, no, we don't. Well, I didn't buy it. So when we went to take her deposition in the case, what do you think happened when I said, what did your investigation find? Objection, attorney-client privilege. Okay. Yeah. So attorneys, in my experience, rarely find their own clients guilty. I don't know about you guys, but when you hire a lawyer, they never find their clients guilty. If they find something that's negative about the client, very typically what happens is the report gets shit canned or disappears, or they refuse to produce it, which is precisely what happened at Michigan State, for example. They said they did an independent investigation, and when we pressed them and wanted it a discovery, they said, well, we didn't do an independent investigation. Or would they, you know, and to this day, Michigan State has not released their own internal findings, and there's a huge fight even today about that. You know, I don't know a lot about this particular case, but I do know about the law firm they hired, which is Thompson and Horton. And Thompson and Horton, as I understand it, is a Texas law firm, most famous or infamous for the Baylor University rape scandal, where they were accused by the victims of essentially saying, when they raped you, what were you wearing? Or words to that effect. Mm-hmm. That's what was reported anyway. That would not be my choice for an independent investigation about abuse, unless I was an institution that wanted to try to protect myself. These independent investigations are simply cover, in my opinion, for the institution, and they want to look like they're doing something. I'll give you another example. USC, the Dr. Tyndall case, which Dr. Piasecki, did I pronounce that right, by the way?
Piasecki, close enough.
Piasecki, all right, fair enough. Essentially mentioned before, Dr. Tyndall was the gynecologist at the student center from 1986 to 2016. And USC hired a Melvin Ian Myers, big international law firm, defense law firm, to do an investigation, said they were going to release it 4 months after it was done. It's never been released. And you can't compel it because of the attorney-client privilege. So this is what you've described here with this independent investigation at the University of Idaho is sort of standard practice for most of these institutions who have engaged in or allegedly engaged in misconduct.
Now, John, one of the things that Lori and I were talking about before we started recording this episode was that Scott Reed from the Orange County Register released another article yesterday stating that the university announced that they will not be releasing their findings from the investigation.
Yeah, shocking.
Not for you to speculate on why not, but why do organizations normally not share the findings?
Because it's bad. I mean, when you say you're going to do an independent investigation and then you decide not to report it, I think it's fair to conclude that it's really bad. What I would wonder is, you know, if I were a member of the legislature in Ohio, or a member of the board of trustees of the university or regents or whatever they call them, or the governor or the attorney general, why are these public officials not screaming to have this released? These are public funds used for this investigation. There are serious allegations involved. There's public money involved. And do we just be quiet because it's some sport and it's the University of Idaho? And I think what that reflects is, especially with female athletes, because we saw this in Nassar, is, you know, a real cultural problem with the institution. And, you know, when you say you're going to do something and you're a public entity and we're going to do an investigation and then you decide we're going to hide it, that's what the Catholic bishops used to do in sex abuse cases. You know, that's what chemical companies do. It's what, you know, bad actors in corporate America do. It's not what, you know, criminal defense attorneys don't disclose their investigations to the public. And so I think it's fair to conclude there's something in there that's adverse. And I would hope that somebody in public office would step up and say, it's not okay. What you're doing is wrong. And you're going to release the report. And frankly, what happened in Nassar is we actually were able to go to the United States Senate because they had oversight of the Olympic Committee and change the law, but also force these people to come and testify. And, you know, for example, they subpoenaed Steve Penny, who was the president of U.S. State Gymnastics, who invoked the Fifth. The legislature in Idaho has the power to issue subpoenas to state officials. Do it. You know, get one of these committees and call them and investigate. These are, you know, kids that go to a public school that's funded by the legislature. They have oversight responsibilities. Do your job.
Right. Now, to follow on with that, John, is why do sports organizations, whether they're national governing bodies or professional youth sports or even universities, stick to retaining the toxic and abusive coach instead of doing the right thing and actually cutting ties with them or firing them or even further legal action after that? Why do they back that person as long as possible, like in the Larry Nassar case or at USC or any other cases you've worked? What have you seen, and why have organizations said, or have they even said, why they kept on retaining that person or people?
There's a variety of reasons. You know, the classic example, in my view, of the abusive coach were the Carolis, Bella and Marta Caroli, who were running USA Gymnastics program from the mid-80s through 2016. And they were retained because they were perceived as being successful and winning gold medals, et cetera. In my view, the background on those two birds was that they were both Nadia Comăneci's coach, who was, you know, the great Romanian gymnast who, you know, won in, I think it was 1976 or 1980, I don't remember. But they were in Romania when Nicolae Ceaușescu was the communist dictator. And Romania was arguably the most repressive communist state in the former Soviet bloc. And Ceaușescu was this sort of brutal dictator. And for a variety of reasons, the Carolis fell out of favor. Their story was they defected to the U.S. in 1981 because they wanted freedom. They defected because they were in deep shit at home in Romania. And basically, they opened a gym in Houston. And, you know, the stories about what they did and the abuse that they allowed, physical abuse that they allowed to occur on their at their ranch, which was called the Caroli Ranch, where until 2018, all USA Gymnastics training was held. And it changed because Simone Biles refused to go back, who I'm proud to say was our client and is our client. They kept them because they perceived them to be winners. Sometimes coaches are retained because you have a totally corrupt environment, for example. There's NCAA violations. There's other types of misconduct. And they know. And if you get rid of them, they'll tell on you. Sometimes it's because they are in some sort of relationship with somebody in charge. I mean, so the reasons abound, but the bottom line is culturally, the institutions that do this are not prioritizing their athletes. And I think there's a perception out there is that if you don't deprioritize your athletes, you can't win. And I don't think that's true. I think there are a number of programs around the country where you have incredibly successful athletic programs. For example, the University of Oklahoma's gymnastics program consistently either winning the national championship or close to it. And almost to a person, you talk to the women who graduated from that program and participated in that program, and they'll say wonderful things about the coach who's there. So in terms of the Carolis, I think most of my clients agree, they won gold in spite of the Carolis, not because of them. And remember, Marta Caroli is the person who allowed Larry Nassar access to all those women and allowed them to be abused at the Olympics. So anyway.
And John,
that
my
brings
final
up a
question
really...
on that specific one is, do you think that if a organization lets go of the coach or the toxic or abusive person, do you think that the organization thinks that it will imply that something actually happened, so that's why they continue to employ that person?
Possibly. I mean, the irony is about, so I think what you're talking about is fear of civil liability, right? So I think a lot of people assume that if there's abuse by a coach engaging in criminal conduct, for example, slapping somebody, assaulting somebody physically or sexually or otherwise, that there's automatic liability for the institution. That's not the law. The law in almost every state is, in order for the institution to be liable, they had to be negligent, and usually sometimes that means they knew or had reason to know. So let's say institution X has a football coach, and the football coach is punching players in the back of the head, right? Criminal act. And the player goes to the school and said, hey, coach is punching me in the back of the head, punching other players in the back of the head, and and doing this stuff, and the school terminates him. There's no liability, because they as soon as they knew, they did something. Here, if Scott's report is to be believed, and I will tell you that the first person to write about abuse in USA Gymnastics in the United States was Scott Reed. So I give Scott's opinion a lot of weight. If he's to be believed and his story is to be believed, the first time this came up, they could have investigated and terminated him. And the fact that they haven't, means they own it. So whatever he does from now on, they own. And if you think about it, not only is it wrong, because assuming that it's correct, and I don't know if it is or not, but hypothetically, if it's correct, what he's doing is wrong. But secondly, it's stupid legal strategy. Stupid. If you know it's true, pull the plug, get rid of him or her.
And they've actually almost doubled down on this coach in this particular, situation at Idaho. And that brings up, I want to touch base a little bit on the role of the enablers, right? Because in everything that we've talked about now, it's the abuse is elevated, to a certain level because of the people around the situation, building that toxic culture that are enabling, things to happen, whether it's turning a blind eye or putting, like you said, a really stupid legal strategy in place or not having a strategy, at all, who you engage, as your law firm and such. So I, just couple of points or couple of questions is this, the coach at Idaho is still the coach, right? And Scott has been doing a number of follow-up, articles, but one of the athletes who has identified herself, right, and has been quite vocal, and will be on our podcast with us is a young woman named Emma Patterson, right? And Emma is a transfer. She's from Idaho, but she transferred back into the University of Idaho, a place that she describes as, being a part of her soul, right? A part of her DNA, fourth generation, Idaho Vandal. And, a couple of the things that she touches on in our chat with her is, at first really becoming suspicious of talking to an outside law firm, like, who are they? Are they supposed to represent us, as the victims, or, why would I want to speak to this firm, if they're not representing me, if they're representing, somebody else's best interest. But also another point that was raised by victims, it turns out, of this coach from other institutions, right, from years past. I guess maybe you've seen this before, maybe you can give some context. There seem to have been attempts to warn the athletic director, Terry Golic, at the University of Idaho, that this particular head coach did have a pattern of behavior, right, that could at very least be termed, potentially abusive. There were at least two written letters that Scott was able to obtain, from the authors, and verify that reached out in the 2022 season shortly after hearing the news that this particular individual was hired at the university, right? So the role of the enablers, right? Talk to us a little bit. I mean, we talked about you know, basically everybody in the Nassar case was an enabler to Nassar, right? Whether it was, you know, the Carollis giving him the opportunity, or people, other people not reporting, you know, the abuse on behalf of the victims, right? Mandated, you know, reporting. But I wonder if you can just touch a little bit on what your experience has been with, you know, the role of the enabler, right? And also, like, how do you,
Yeah, no, so obviously I can't speak to the Idaho case specifically because I don't have
the facts.
But what I can tell you is, first of all, about the young athlete who is wondering about whether she should do an interview with that firm. I wouldn't let that firm interview my Boston Terrier, let alone an athlete or a human being. They're not there to help you. They're there to protect the university. And frankly, what I would do is file a Title IX complaint with the Office of, the Department of Education about, not only about the abuse, but about, it being gender focused. I mean, one of the things that was very helpful in both Michigan State, USC, and others is that the Department of Education's, office came in and did stinging and stunningly critical reports on both Michigan State and USC and find them. If you want somebody independent, go there. And frankly, the university, if he really was going to be independent, they should have disclosed that the university has an attorney-client relationship with this firm. And that's the first thing I would ask. Do you have an attorney-client relationship? But in terms of enablers, what I can tell you from, whether it's schools, hospitals, churches, or other institutions that deal with children or vulnerable adults, abuse never happens in a vacuum over time. It might happen initially, and then if somebody catches them, they stop. But when you have long-term abuse at multiple institutions, as apparently is the allegation at Ida with this coach, there's always enablers. And, when it's children, I would say that our job as an adult is to stand between the abuser and the children that he or she would hurt. And I would say the same thing with coaches. Coaches are in a position of trust. They have a unique relationship with their athletes. They're not only, athletics is supposed to be a process where not only do you try to win, but you try to grow as a human being. That's the whole point of sports. I mean, I don't know what the percentage of people that actually get paid in college now or even play professionally, but it's still very small in terms of any kind of significant money. Kids are there to get an education, to form themselves, not only educationally, but morally and spiritually. And, when somebody's in a position of authority, it's like the military. When I was in the military and I called my superior sir or ma'am. And when you're an athlete, you call your coach, you don't call him Bill or Jim or Janice, it's coach. And it's a sign of respect. And the coach determines whether you play. And very frequently, the coach determines whether or not you have your scholarship. And a lot of these kids come from families that can't afford to go to college. And that's their ticket, to really a different life. And so in many ways, the school owns them. And when you place somebody in that position, you best be sure that that person is fit to coach, to coach athletes. And then when you have a male coach coaching female athletes, I think you have to use extra sensibilities because it's just a different it's a different power structure. If a male coach puts his hand on a woman, let alone a young man, but if he puts his hand on an athlete to shove them, frankly, he should be hauled out by the back of his neck and thrown out of the school and charged, in my opinion, if that happened. Mm-hmm.
So John, some of the things that Scott's original article, some of the things that were revealed, is exactly what you've been touching on. There's been physical abuse in the form of, athletes being pushed over during drills, during skills drill or defensive drills or some type of engagement in practice. There's been body shaming verbal abuse. You know, there's been endangerment in one report made to the university pretty early on in this 2023 season of excessive speed, right? Athletes being driven over 100 miles an hour by an assistant coach, you know, with video proof, right? And in every, I guess, you know, maybe it's not a question, but historically speaking, in the cases that you've been involved with, obviously, you know, not in the Idaho case, but in the cases that you've been involved with, one of the things we're noticing, you know, with the women that we're speaking to, and from what Scott has uncovered, you know, in his reporting, is over and over and over again, the victims kept saying, "We don't feel safe, right? We don't feel, you know," and who else can they tell that to? If not, they've told that to every single, you know, on the record, off the record, they've told that to every single person whose paths they've crossed, who are supposed to have a duty of care, right, to them, whether it's the coach themselves. They started out by going directly to the coach. Like you said, it's a sign of respect, right? You have a problem, you go to the source, you try to work it out. Well, that was futile. You know, they went to the athletic administrators. They went to the dean of students, you know, and the president of the university, who one of the victims is his niece. You know, so now you're talking about, like, who else can these women go to? You know, I said the only person who really was able to, you know, give them voice, but still isn't physically there to keep them safe, was Scott Reeve. You know, so it took a reporter from all these hundreds of miles away, right, to help give them voice in their situation. But over and over and over, you hear these victims saying, "I don't feel safe. I don't feel safe talking to this law firm. I don't feel safe going in to have a meeting with the AD. You know, I don't feel safe at practice." And, you know, I guess in every case you've seen, maybe there's been a situation where the victims have been put back in the hands, you know, of their abuser. And that's exactly what we're seeing in this particular, you know, situation, is that the individual is still employed. The individual has not, you know, had any pause in their employment, and the athletes are still technically at the mercy, you know, their scholarships, their future, if you will, at the university is in his hands.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, the only way, given those facts, if what you're saying is correct, and obviously I don't know the facts, is universities don't respond until you place their brand at issue. What's strange about athletic academic institutions is very frequently there's no one in charge. And let me tell you what I mean by that. There, even though there's a structure there and there's a board of regents and there's a president, et cetera, in most of these instances, these institutions are fiefdom, and the only thing the folks above them do is give them a budget. Okay. And one doesn't want to get involved with the other. So the only time you get their attention is when you place their brand at issue. Okay. So, for example, at Baylor, which was a horrible situation where you had football players raping students, it didn't get attention until there was media, national media. At Michigan State, same thing. We never got any attention or any traction until the Indianapolis Star wrote a story about Nassar, and we were able to get it on 60 Minutes. You know, at USC, there was no action on Dr. Tyndall, and it became a front page story at the Los Angeles Times. And believe me, you know, this can happen. You know, institutions frequently don't realize how fragile they are until they're too late. And if you doubt me, look at Penn State. I mean, even today, 11 years after Jerry Sandusky, the most, you know, the most people think of when you hear about Penn State is not, you know, their great legacy, the great institute, the educational institution is, it's that they harbored a pedophile coach for years, and it does tremendous damage. And so what I would say is, you know, you're one legislative hearing or one national story away from really wiping out your reputation. And I think frequently they're, you know, frankly, I'm going to be very blunt with you, the attitude of administrators and coaches and athletic directors is fuck them. There's a million girls that want to play volleyball. Fuck them. You know, you don't like it, leave. We don't have to listen to you. When, you know, if one or two, it's always possible you have one or two or three athletes who are, you know, just never going to be satisfied or complainers. You know, that happens. People sometimes are just, you know, troubled and whatever. But when you have this many women complaining about this stuff consistently and over a number of schools, I would think that would get somebody's attention. And if it's not, it's because they're being deliberately indifferent. And frankly, that's exactly what the Title IX process is about. And, you know, it takes a long time, but I would hope that if I were representing these young women, I would tell them to immediately apply to that. I would also suggest that they look at who's on the House and Senate, you know, education committees and call them. I mean, there's two United States senators from Idaho. There's at least one member of Congress. You know, call them. They get federal money. It's their bailiwick. And ask what the hell's going on. The other thing I would do is, frankly, is I don't trust SafeSport, but I'd make a complaint to SafeSport and ask them to investigate it, because I guarantee you he's USA Volleyball, you know, associated. So. And like I said, I'm not commenting on the validity of the allegations at all. I'm just telling you what I would do if hypothetically this was my situation that I had to handle.
Now, some of these athletes have last season and then after this season went in the transfer portal and have moved schools or are currently in the process of trying to find another school. During this investigation, that was started by the university, and a law firm was brought in that was paid for by the university. During this investigation, there's things that are to come out. Do you think that that information is going to be used for the benefit of the athletes to try to solve the issue, or do you think the investigation is more about how much liability does a university have? I guess that's my first question for you.
You know, obviously I don't know the facts here as we talked about, but I can tell you in every situation I've ever encountered with independent investigations, it's been about protecting the university. You know, if frankly, if you had an abusive coach and you had an institution that knew about it, they don't need an investigation. You just deal with it. You know, You can investigate internally. There's a lot of, or you suspend him while he's being investigated with pay. But the message they're sending to the athletes is exactly what I said. You don't matter. You know, and when somebody sends that message, you should believe them. If that was my daughter, I'd want her to leave. I certainly wouldn't send my child there, but there's, you know, I guarantee you the sad part is there's lots of parents who would sign their kid up to go because, you know, they get a free education and, you know, the university probably, the athletic department of the coach probably gives them a line of stuff that is, there's no legitimacy to it, et cetera. Like I said, this is hypothetical, but that's what I think. I think that sadly, you know, and there's a volleyball coach in Illinois who has been suspended from USA Volleyball, who has a horrendous record of abuse. He's not allowed to coach in any USA Volleyball context because of a history of, I believe, of sexual abuse. And he's still coaching, and there's still parents that pay him to send their kids there. So it's a sad state of affairs.
So coaches talk to each other, right? So these athletes who went in the transfer portal and whether they were picked up or not, do you think in your past experience with the other athletes that you've supported over time, did they have trouble going to new programs, to new coaches, you know, just because information travels like, oh, this athlete is a whistleblower, or this athlete is making false claims, or this athlete is hurting my career? Does that information normally go from coach to coach, and then that coach doesn't necessarily believe what they heard, but they also don't necessarily want to take a risk on the athlete? Do you happen to find cases of that through representing your past athlete clients?
Well, yeah, if you complain, you can easily be labeled a problem child, you know, and it's harder to get people to take a chance on you. It's just like any sport, you know. And the reality is no athlete should be placed in that position. That's the fault. If there's abuse going on, that's the fault of the university at issue and their administration. I'm sure that they're encountering that. And, you know, it's When you agree to go to a university and play a sport, there's an implied bargain, which is I'm gonna play for you, but I get to be you're gonna treat me fairly and be concerned about my welfare. For example, if I injure my ankle, I'm gonna get treatment. Okay, well, you know, if there's serious emotional and physical abuse going on, you have an obligation to treat that person, to prevent it, first of all. Like taping an ankle prevents an ankle injury. You have an obligation as a university to prevent that. And when it happens, you have an obligation to say, number one, athlete, this isn't your fault. Number two, we're going to deal with this appropriately. And, when that doesn't occur, you know, it's certainly not the fault of the athlete, but they end up holding the bag.
One of the things that you brought up earlier was like a football coach, you're just using an example, a football coach hitting the back of an athlete's helmet or punching the back of an athlete's helmet. Can you explain the difficulty of a toxic, abusive, and abusive culture and also being able to address it through the law, whether it's legal law or through civil law?
Sure. I mean, there's... In coaching, there's different styles. Some, you know, are more aggressive than others, and you know, there's emotions expressed on a field. And hey, you fuck that play up. You know, don't do it again. Come on, man. I mean, and that's maybe that's strong language, but you know, that frankly, you know, in the context of a college football program, that doesn't trouble me. What troubles me is, you know, hitting somebody, beating them up, calling them names, threatening them with, some sort of physical punishment, allowing teammates to abuse them physically, et cetera. And, you know, I want to be clear. This is not about being woke. Okay, this is not about, oh, I need a safe place and don't harm my feelings. That's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about is real abusive, horrible, and sometimes criminal conduct. Okay, so I just want to be clear, because a lot of folks will say, well, you know, do you want to win? And that's just coaching. No, that's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about strong words. We're talking about, you know, real physical conduct that hurts people, just horrific behavior that's outside the bounds of any kind of civil, anybody in good conscience could accept. So I want to be clear about what we're chatting about. So the challenge with it criminally is, unless you have a video and it's the coach and the athlete, very frequently they won't charge them. Civilly, it's different. And the standard of proof is different. So in a criminal case, the standard of proof, what you have to show to a jury, is it's beyond a reasonable doubt that a crime was committed. And when the coach says one thing and the athlete says another, that can be very difficult. In a civil context, the standard's different. It's called preponderance of the evidence. And what that really means is that I have to show, as the lawyer for the plaintiff, for the victim, that this happened the person was damaged. And the standard of proof means, the jury instruction literally says, is it more likely than not that occurred? Okay. It's a much lower standard of proof. It's not easy, but it's much lower. And there's a variety of ways you can prove it. I can use prior conduct to prove it. I can use a whole variety of witnesses to prove it. And very frequently, for example, in our cases, we file a civil case, which actually leads to criminal charges being imposed after the civil case. I can think of a case we tried in 2012 in Stockton, California, against a priest who, after we got a verdict against him, was charged criminally with sexual abuse. So I hope that answers your question, but that's just a little bit of the difference.
No, it does. Thank you. Okay, my next question is, John, is you mentioned a couple minutes ago about things that happen in the locker room. Like, there might be, athletes, or we could call them toxic followers, that might be assaulting other athletes because the coach has manipulated or pressed the athletes to do something that they wouldn't normally do on their own, because it's such an extremely toxic and abusive culture. Do you find that happening a lot, you know, whether it's mental, physical, or emotional, that where a coach or a GM or, you know, whatever case the level is, but where the organization is putting pressure on other athletes to try to stop a whistleblower athlete, or not even a whistleblower athlete, but an athlete who is providing a genuine grievance. Do you see any of that, or do you see a lot of it? What have you seen in the past?
Sure. We've had cases, mostly high school cases, but others, where, for example, in a football context, they use a quote unquote hazing ritual to control athletes. I can think of one case that was covered by ESPN where a high school football team was sodomizing football players with broomsticks as a hazing ritual. And it's really about power and control. I know that sounds hard to believe, but it happens. There were other cases. There's been a case that Mr. Reed wrote about at my alma mater, Mater Dei High School, where there was allegedly a hazing ritual that involved fighting, where they would beat the living snot out of one another, and they called it bodies. You know, the school denied it, the coach denied it. There was a video of some of it. The DA reviewed it. There were no charges filed. But that kind of culture, that where you have a culture of violence, is absolutely toxic. I mean, in the military, they used to have something called a code red, which you never saw a few good men, the Marine Corps, you know, would some Marine Corps senior enlisted will allow other enlisted to do to weaker Marines. The Marine Corps absolutely will never let that happen today. And if you do, you're going to get charged with a court martial and get thrown out. I can't think of anything worse than being abused by your peers, because a coach wants that to happen, but it does. It doesn't happen all the time. And frankly, it doesn't happen in programs where, you know, you have a coach who cares about kids. And, you know, part of your job as a coach is to guide your athletes. You know, male athletes' brains, young men's brains, we now know, don't fully mature until age 28. Used to be 25, now they're saying 28. Women, it's younger. But these are young people who don't have a lot of life experience and who are easily influenced. And it's important to remember that. And it's important to know that parents, even though they're adults legally, they're entrusting their children to these schools. And, you know, they ought to be treated, you know, there's an old saying in law or maxim called in loco parentis, means in the place of the parents. And that's really how these schools should function. And if they're not, there's something very wrong. And, you know, the sad thing is, like with my alma mater, USC, there were so many women that were abused at that university, and the university knew and let it happen by Dr. Tyndall. And, you know, you want to love your university. People fly their SC flag, and in Southern California, you can't drive through a neighborhood without a USC flag flying. And frankly, I wouldn't put that flag up for love nor money, given what I know about my university in that case. It's very sad, but that's the truth. Frequently, they don't live up to what they say they're supposed to do. And I think it's all of our jobs to call them out on it so we can change it. And the change is possible. I've seen it.
No, that's great to hear that change is possible. And we do hope that organizations do make that change, and they're happy about making that change, and not just to check a box or to get out of the limelight, you know, just so everyone forgets the bad that happened at their organization. Yep. I do have two more questions that I'm going to turn over to Lori to finish up the episode here. The first question is in a lot of the cases that you worked with, and I know it's not all cases, And the reason I asked this question is through my own doctoral research, which I took many years, too many years to complete. Is it the initial action of what a coach or an athletic director or a staff member does that's the biggest problem? Or is it all the actions after the complaint is filed that makes the situation that much worse for the athletes or that much worse for the person that you're representing?
Well, look, I mean, there's a couple of things. First of all, when somebody complains and you're talking about a minor child, so in California, that would be, you know, under 18, your first job as a school administrator is to pick up the phone and report. You have to report to Child Protective Services and or the police immediately. So if you're not doing that, and frankly, it almost never happens, you're violating the law. Your job is not to investigate, it's to report. Once you report, you should wait a short period of time, according to federal law, to allow law enforcement to investigate, and then you should investigate yourself. The other thing you should do is notify the parents. I can't tell you how many cases we have where, and what makes juries irate, is you have an allegation of sexual abuse by a coach, teacher, priest, what have you. It comes to the attention of the authorities, and no one calls the parents and tells them. I mean, you know, as a lawyer, if you want to show malicious intent, not calling the parents and telling them their child was assaulted shows malicious intent. And more often than not, that's the case. If you do the right thing, and it's not hard to do the right thing. It may take courage to do the right thing, but the right thing is to say, if you've got an 18-year-old college freshman example who's shoved down on the floor by our coach, hypothetically, and I'm not talking about Idaho, I'm just talking about hypothetically, first thing you should do is call at a public university, call the police. They have arrest powers. The second thing you do is, if you have reasonable suspicions to believe it, you suspend the coach and you investigate. You let the police investigate locally, or you hire somebody truly independent who doesn't have an attorney-client relationship with you to investigate. And then you offer the athlete counseling, you encourage them to tell their parents and get them involved. And if you do it that way, if you play it straight, you don't have liability, the athlete doesn't feel segregated, you haven't tainted him or her with a brush that you're a problem child, and you oftentimes you get to the truth, right? And it doesn't, just because somebody says it happened doesn't mean it did, right? So but when you immediately go into cover-up mode and stonewall mode, it has the complete opposite effect. It's incredibly bad legal strategy, number one. Number two is you're not going to get to the truth. And more significantly, you're possibly putting other athletes in harm's way, you know? And the other thing of it you got to keep in mind about physical abuse in sports is the reason Larry Nassar was so successful at abusing Olympic athletes is because they were being physically and emotionally abused by the Carolis. He was the nice guy. So when you have that toxic environment, it's very easy for a sexual predator with children to step in and groom their families, say, I care about you. They would deny him food. For example, he would give them food. He would be nice to him. Hey, you're going to be okay, blah, 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 blah. And he was sexually abusing him. So it's when you have a toxic environment where no one can speak and fear reigns, it can lead to all kinds of other bad things.
No, thank you. Thank you for sharing that, John. My final question before I turn it over to Lori is, if you had anything to say to these women who have made these allegations, what would you say to them, whether it's their current situation now, whether it was standing up and saying something, whether it's how to protect themselves, what would you say to them? Well, or any other athlete around the world who's dealing with the same issue?
Sure. What I would say is that it takes courage to do what you're doing. But speak up, because you will never meet the other young women you save, but they exist. And that's what I said to the to Maggie Nichols, and to Allie Raisman, and to Ms. Biles, Simone, and Michaela Maroney, who were the first few women to speak up, is you will never meet the little girls you save from Larry Nassar, but they exist. And, you know, it when you're going through the hell that athletes go through when their universities turn on them, that's probably small comfort, but your suffering is important. And, you know, our jobs as human beings are to protect people that can't protect themselves. That's our jobs.
Great. So, John, we can't thank you enough for bringing your perspective and your lens, you know, on this subject. I know this is not a case that you are, you know, adjudicating or familiar with, but I think that the experience that you have, you know, and you're absolutely right in your final words, is that this has become a global conversation, at least in the sport of volleyball. And one thing we keep touching on is you can replace the word volleyball with any other sport. Right. And the things that we're seeing, you know, in this case, definitely can travel through. So on this episode of Culture and Sports, we have the privilege of speaking with John Manley, who's been giving us his perspective, his expertise, you know, some words of wisdom and best practices, you know, not only for institutions, but for the victims and the survivors, many of whom, you know, John has advocated for as the founder and partner of Manley Stewart and Finaldi, what I would characterize as one of the leading law firms in the nation, if not the world, and handling cases about abuse and really providing advocacy for victims and survivors. Again, thank you, John, for joining us, talking about toxic culture, not everyone's favorite topic, but I think that some of the information, you know, that you've shared with us about your past cases, about the things that you've seen, you know, from the legal side, whether it be criminal or civil, really play into this case that we're studying, you know, this season on the Culture and Sports podcast. So we just want to thank you very much for your time and your expertise and for opening up a good, you know, good part of this conversation that, you know, that will continue on through the season. Jeremy?
Thanks for bringing focus to it. I appreciate it.
And that's a wrap for this week's episode of the Culture and Sports podcast. We hope that this episode has started an internal dialogue, or even one with your team, about the importance of leadership and organizational culture. If you'd like to learn more about Culture and Sports, the Culture and Sports podcast, or other programs, go to cultureandsports.com, where there is a wealth of resources, articles, research, podcasts, video shows, webinars, and courses. And don't forget to connect with us on social media, on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, YouTube, and LinkedIn at Culture and Sports, and on Twitter at Culture in Sport. Thank you for tuning in to the Culture and Sports podcast.